An incredible story. Charles Hall with us, author of Millennial Hospitality Series. That has nothing to do with hospitals or anything like that. You'll find out in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. It's been 9 years since I had Charles Hall on the show with me. 9 years. He enlisted in the Air Force back in 1964 while stationed at Nellis Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas. He served for extensive periods of time in the desert on the gunnery ranges at Indian Springs, Nevada. After Charles had been married for about 6 months, he made a decision. He decided to risk telling his wife about the extraterrestrials that he had encountered at Indian Springs. I wonder if you would do that. 18 years later, his wife convinced him to publish what eventually became the Millennial Hospitality Series. And here's Charles Hall back on Coast to Coast. Wow, it's been a long time, Charles.
Thank you for having me.
And what a story. I mean, truly a remarkable, strange story. Let's go way back. Tell us about this. What happened to you? What'd you see? What'd you hear?
Well, I enlisted in the Air Force on July 20th, 1964, and I was supposed to go to radio intercept analysis school, spy school at 101. They butched my orders, and I ended up at weather training school in Chinook Air Force Base, Illinois. In March of 1965, having completed weather training school, I reported for duty at Nellis Air Force Base in outside Las Vegas, Nevada, as a weather observer. I was an enlisted man, and so I had two stripes at the time, and those days are described in books 1 and books 4 and books 2 and books 3, but mm-hmm. the arriving in Nellis and stuff like that is described in book 1 and book 4. And I was, after I was stationed, as I was hardly, I'd hardly gotten settled in at Nellis, and they wanted me they assigned me to be the temporary duty to be the weather observer at Indian Springs, which is the auxiliary field for where the gunnery ranges are, which was 90 miles or so northwest of Nellis. And when I was up there, I discovered that at the north end of Indian Springs Valley, there was a base in those mountains at the very northern end, which the Air Force maintained for extraterrestrials. Those were the tall white extraterrestrials. And those days are described in my books, the first 4 books. During my time as a weather observer, I personally stood in front of 3 different types of extraterrestrials, the tall whites at Indian Springs that I describe in books 1 through 4, the Norwegians with 24 teeth who are so much like us that they could walk in among us, and if you weren't a dentist, you'd never know the difference. And then the Grays of Roswell. And during the time that I was at Nellis, I had additional TDYs, which I describe in Book 5, up to the areas where the Grays are. And that's in Book 5.
Now, these visitations of the craft, Charles, were they done in cooperation with government, or yeah, were they just happening on their own?
No, the U.S. government built, for the tall whites at Indian Springs, the U.S. government built the base, and although the tall whites have been here for several thousand years, the base at Indian Springs, the U.S. government built for them, and the top of the mountain at the north end of Indian Springs in 1965 had a double security perimeter. And it's literally the back door to Area 51, but it's like in 1965 it was called, it's the original Dreamland. And the outer perimeter was maintained by the U.S. government. The inner perimeter was maintained by the tall whites themselves, and it was treated like a foreign embassy. Everything inside the inner perimeter is whatever the tall whites wanted it to be. The base was used as a as the same way that we have airports, only it was used as a spaceport for the tall whites. The tall white deep spacecraft would arrive and leave on schedule, on a monthly schedule, and they'd put in, and that's where they would be repaired and refueled and refurbished and then send out to space again. The deep spacecraft would typically come in on the night of at sundown, on the night of the full moon. They might come in a day or two early or a day or two late, depending on, you know, the schedule. Mm-hmm. But the biggest ones typically came in right at sundown.
Was the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind based on any of this?
I have no idea what the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was based on, but I note that the short white extraterrestrials portrayed in the movie, in real life, those would have been the children of the tall whites. Because, see, all aliens are flesh and blood creatures, as you and I are, and the tall whites had men, women, and children, and traveled in family groups. The Greys also have men, women, and children, and travel in family groups, and the Norwegians with 24 teeth, just like us, have men, women, and children, and travel in family groups. The difference is that the adult white, tall whites, and the Norwegians with 24 teeth can breathe our air, but the adult Greys cannot breathe our air without a breathing device. Whereas the teenagers and the children of the Greys, they can breathe our air directly. But as they grow, their body demands more oxygen than our air provides, and they have to switch over to some type of thing that filters nitrogen out of our air and for the adults. This means that there's a substantial difference in the way that you interact with the Greys as opposed to the whites and the Norwegians. The Norwegians are so much like us that...
Are they the Anunnaki that Zechariah Sitchin wrote about, Charles, a long time ago in his works?
I have no idea. I can only talk about my own personal experiences because I'm not familiar. I'm not able to say what the Anunnaki would be or the Nordics. I can only talk about the ones that I've personally met. And so, you know, I'm sorry, but that question you'll have to ask him.
Well, he's no longer with us.
So. Yeah, I'm the one that coined the term tall whites and the term Norwegians with 24 teeth. And in book five, I also describe what I believe happened, I have good reason to believe, happened at Roswell and in 1947. And that's based on my own personal experience among the Greys. If you'll read my book, when you read my fifth book, The Greys, you'll see that the first half is my personal experiences. And the second half is what I believe happened at Roswell based on my personal experiences. You see, when a person analyzes a UFO event, in my humble opinion, they really should start by asking the question, what is the source of propulsion? Because that's how you tell the difference between, some dogs or, you know, natural phenomena, mm-hmm. as opposed to Air Force planes, as opposed to true alien craft. True.
And we know they're not using our propulsion system.
Yes. You see, space is so vast that in order to make the deep space crossing, the craft cannot leave anything behind because space is so vast. That means that the tall white craft and the gray craft and the Norwegian, and I'll only talk about the tall white and the gray craft for the in this context. That means that when their technology must propel the craft without like rockets or leaving an ion trail or anything. Otherwise, to make the crossing to the next star, you'd need a fuel tank the size of the moon. And so, see, there's more to physics than what Einstein knew about. And in my books, I also describe Hall photon theory, which I describe why I have a master's degree in nuclear physics. And I describe why I believe that there are more force fields than what, you know, like gravity, like electricity, like magnetism. Well, there's more of those than what Einstein knew about.
Well, Charles, and let me ask you, though, but back years ago when we talked, you know, you said that at that time that you didn't have any pictures, you didn't have any physical evidence. Has that changed at all, or is that the same?
No, that's the same. When I came off the ranges, I did not bring anything with me except my memories. I did not bring any logs or diaries or anything. The ranges were a secure, you know, they were a classified area inside a classified area inside a classified area. You know, you're not supposed to take pictures, you know. And if I did, where would you put them anyway, since the tall whites came into my barracks and looked in my locker, you know. So, you know, and with their electronics could tell what a person was thinking, so what's the point, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, when I was out there among the tall whites and the grays, there's always, even when they're friendly, there's always a tension because they're not human. And I'm not an alien, I'm human. And it means that even simple things like taking out a camera and taking a picture is going to be misinterpreted by a new arrival. They're going to think that's a weapon and fire on you.
Or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and see, when I was out there, I was always by myself. My order said I could go anywhere I wanted in dreamland, and day or night, no questions asked, but I had to be perfectly alone. I could only go there. I could never take anyone else out there with me, and I never did, and that meant that when I was out there, like, gee, as you see in Book 5, sometimes I was like more than 100 miles out there.
What made you decide to go public with all this?
Well, see, what I wanted was to write my memoirs. Going out there back in the 60s, that was a very emotional experience. I was young. I was in the Air Force. And I wanted to write my memoirs for my children or grandchildren so they would know how it was, how I felt, the emotions that I felt. And I really, you know, all I was trying to do is to capture day by day how it felt to live those days, to count those hours, to be afraid like that, or the emotions that I felt, and pass them on to my children or grandchildren so that they could understand what it had been like for me. I really have no interest in, I mean, whatever the government does is whatever the government's going to do. They have their reasons. And when you've seen the different extraterrestrials up close, a lot of the government policies make perfect sense. And so I'm not trying to get the U.S. government to do anything that it wouldn't otherwise do, you know. All I'm trying to do is to explain to the reader, originally intended to be just my children and grandchildren, how it felt to, in 1965, to get up at midnight in my barracks at Indian Springs, totally alone, and discover that there were aliens in the barracks, men, women, and children, and that they'd come for the children to play and watch me go to the bathroom and shave. And for 6 months, I was in terror and thought I was nuts. Okay, and you see that in the course of being out there, I believe I felt every emotion a human can feel, from abject fear to despair I'm very religious, I'm Roman Catholic, to laughter, because, well, like the night that I was out at Range 3 in 1965 in the summer, and I had parked my truck, because I had my own truck, I could go anywhere, I'd parked my truck out at Range 3 opposite the supply sheds. Because there was, as you see, there was the generator shack and the supply sheds and my weather shack. And then there was the large building across the way that I call the lounge. And it was a beautiful night and it was warm. And when I'd gone out there, I'd rolled down both windows on my truck, the one on the driver's side and the one on the far side. And I'd parked it just opposite the alleyway or the passageway between the two supply sheds. And I was out at my satellite stand, and I'd released the balloon, and I was tracking it. And because I was, as a weatherman, you had to release the, go out there at like 3 in the morning and release a balloon and so on, measure the winds and the weather and phone NOAA. And of course, the satellite only has like one eyepiece, and so looking through it, you know, if you, you know, when you look through it, you had to, after taking the reading, you had to look away and rest your eyes.
Sure,
I had perfect eyesight. And as I was looking away, I saw these three children of the tall whites with their suits and wearing their suits, which allowed them to levitate. And they had been out in the sagebrush behind the mesquite out behind the supply sheds. And they came trotting and happy, the way children trot onto a playground, happy, down the alleyway. And then the little girl, there was two boys and a girl, the little fat astronaut, the tall Tin Einstein, the one I called the tall Tin Einstein, and the one that was the teacher's daughter, the butterfly. And the little girl, you know, turned out, you know, powered up her suit and floated up and came in through the open window on the passenger side. The tall Tin Einstein powered up and got into the back of the truck, and the little fat astronaut ran around the back and came in and powered up and floated in the store in the driver's side and sat there and put on my hat backwards, my fatigue hat that I'd left in the truck, and proceeded to pretend he was me driving the truck. And as I was standing there at the satellite stand, I didn't yet, every time I saw the flights or anything, I thought it was me. I thought I was nuts, you know. I thought, and I remember standing there looking at them, and they weren't very far away. They were only like, I don't know, 50 feet or something.
And how many were there?
There were three children, and I remember thinking to myself, so this is what insanity is like. And then I was checking to see if I heard anywhere. I said, well, they're right. It's really quite painless. I don't feel anything, and I thought, you know, gee, I wonder how long I'm going to be nuts like this as the kids were sitting there, you know, playing. And then after I finished the run, they were still playing in my truck. They weren't hurting anything, but they were just pretending to be me the way kids were. Since they were perfectly real, they naturally looked perfectly real, except that when they powered on their suits, because there's more to science than what Einstein knew about, and their suits allowed them to levitate, to float. When that happened, I was looking at them, and I thought, they look so real, I can't believe I'm still hallucinating, you know? And so I just walked over there real, you know, kind of laughing the way you might walk over, say, like to the neighbor's dog or that, you know, you might like to pet or something. And I was just kind of laughing, and I was saying, gee, you know, I was saying to myself, gee, I've never seen hallucinations so real. And then the little fat astronaut looked at me kind of like, not really surprised, but looked at me square on and said, oh, you know, time to leave. So then the little girl floated up and went out the passenger side, the window on the passenger side, and the tall Tin Einstein, he hopped off the back, and the little fat astronaut, he hopped out of the window, and they all went running back in the sagebrush. And I thought, well, golly, you know, is insanity supposed to be something different, you know? And I was kind of laughing at myself.
Well, it is a far-fetched story, Charles.
Yeah, and then the next night I wanted to test, and so the next night I left the window up on the passenger side and the window up on the driver's side. And the next night it was like instant replay, only when the kids came out, the little girl was very disappointed because when she floated up, she couldn't come through the window. And so she and the other guy got in the back of the story, or got in the back of the truck. And then the little fat astronaut, he came over to the driver's side, and when he got up, he couldn't go through the window either.
Hold on, Charles. We're going to come back in a moment. Your friend Paula Harris is going to join us to talk about part of this when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Hall with us. And he held a top secret clearance, by the way. And last week, Forbes magazine wrote a story that they got from, I would say, a questionable website, about Edward Snowden. He's the NSA guy who released that information, talking also about the tall whites. I recommend that you take that website as a grain of salt, and for what it's worth, look at it in its entertainment value and do not compare it to some of the things Charles Hall has said. Charles, you know, stories like that that get out, that websites create, they don't help, do they?
Well, I agree with everything you've said. And, you know, if you read my books are based on my personal experiences. But remember that the men who were with me, who also saw, many of the men who were with me and who also saw the tall whites, had a really hard time accepting what reality was. Some of the men thought that the tall whites were ancient Egyptians that had gotten trapped out there, and
like through a time warp or something.
Yeah, others thought that they were ghosts that had somehow materialized. And in book one, I describe how some thought that it was a radioactive white horse that floated around the desert intending to scare people.
I could see that. Let's bring in Paula Harris, by the way. She is the photojournalist and investigative reporter. Hi, Paula.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Charles.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And of course, Paula interviewed and had an opportunity to sit down and talk with Charles and Marie Hall. That was back, what, 10, 11 years ago, Paula?
It was in 2009, and I had met Charles and Marie at Roswell, and Charles was selling his book, and I happened to sit next to him, and he started talking to me, and I looked at him, and I said, you're saying your book is science fiction, but you're remembering this. Is this real? And he said to me, yes, it is. And I said, oh, my God, well, this needs to be researched. And in 2 years, I worked with Charles and Marie, and I also worked with a pilot, a commercial pilot named David Coote, because at that time I was really nervous because David and I flew Charles to Indian Springs and had him recount his story on location. So I thought, how come he can tell me all this? You know, this is such detail. So I worked with the story from 2009 until about 2011. I'm so thrilled that it got out because it needs to get out. It was one of the only stories that had people with their children in it, you know, not just gray aliens, which were, you know, we have as almost mascots for ufology now. But, you know, and I was fascinated, George.
Well, there's no doubt about it. It's an incredible story that happened, you know, around the Air Force Base, which makes it, I think, even more provocative. Paula, you know, last week there was this story that came out from a questionable website. Forbes magazine kind of tongue-in-cheek picked it up, but it kind of alluded to Edward Snowden making these revelations of the tall whites. I don't think he did that. But what's your take on stuff like that? That doesn't help people like you who try to do good research.
Well, I think that we can backtrack a little because Charles Hall's story was something that Paul Hellyer knew about because Paul Hellyer, former defense minister of Canada, mentioned in his speech, you know, he had that famous interview
right.
That's all over the net. He mentioned a weatherman, and he mentioned this story. I think he made a little bit of a mistake when he talked about, you know, Las Vegas, because from what I understand from what Charles said, because of the white skin, they posed as nurses that walked down the street in Vegas because they, you know, they were regular people. The women wanted to buy clothes. The kids had overalls from the Sears Roebuck catalog, which is all logical. And I think that story, that Paul Hellyer's story, caused this other thing to happen. I think it piggybacked on it because they're doing everything in their, you know, power to discredit something as powerful as Paul's coming out with it. You know, Paul, I know for a fact Paul Hellyer has spoken to Charles and was very impressed with his story. So, you know, what it is we get a high-powered guy that comes out that basically is talking about our relationship to aliens, the cosmos, the cover-up, and we have to have a lot of disinformation around it. Otherwise, people believe him.
Yeah, that's true. Charles, have they tried to discredit you at all?
I'm not really sure how to answer that because, you know, what my purpose is to capture how I felt when I lived those years and mm-hmm. to convey that to the people. And, you know, whether the reader, I wrote, the way I wrote the books, the reader can enjoy them whether or not they agree with me or whether or not, right. you know, they can read my books and form their own opinion. You know, I'm not trying to prove that aliens exist in the books. I'm not trying to disprove. Like in book five, where I'm talking about the Roswell, about the Grays, I'm talking about Hall photon theory and the propulsion system, the double hull characteristics of the propulsion system that the tall white craft use and that the gray craft use, both of which I've personally seen out in the desert.
But my point is, did anybody in government or anybody like that try to discredit you to keep you quiet?
Oh, you know, I have fans all over the world, and I, you know, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and when I was in the Air Force, when I was a weather observer, my orders said that nothing I did would ever be classified because I was a weather observer, and because that was the arrangement the tall whites made with the agreement the tall white generals made with the American generals. And so, you know, for that reason, I've been treated differently than what you might think.
But my point is, and I want to make sure you understand this, did anybody in government try to discredit you because you came out to tell this story?
Not directly, but, you know, you always have people, you're not sure, you know, you always have people that... Oh, you know, all over the issue, and you're not always sure where they come from. Yeah.
You know, Paula, because, you know, my point is that I don't think governments want people like Charles Hall to tell the truth. Do you?
No, and that's what confused me. That's why I also pulled in somebody to work with me, because I was real nervous. But then I began to understand they don't want to, but they must have sanctioned this or it would never have come out. There must be some sanction here. Either they didn't think people would believe it or they didn't think it'd go anywhere. If they didn't sanction it, George, he wouldn't be able to talk. And not only that, but, you know, when we did the story a while ago, everybody in the world was going to Indian Springs and camping out there and reporting back, and they wanted to see him and so forth. So people keep asking me, do you think they're there still? And I say, no way. They wouldn't be able to be there. They would have had to be moved, because if Charles comes out with the story, it goes viral. Everybody in the world right. wants to see him. They all go there. They're somewhere else.
But
they must be somewhere else.
But, Charles, you think they're still here on this planet somewhere?
Oh, I'm quite certain they're still here on this planet, because... see, remember that... The tall whites were not in favor of government secrecy. They thought the U.S. government should just say, you know, we have these white friends. That's how the government always addressed them, as our white friends, and tell the people they're here and they're nice and, you know, treat them like you do anybody else.
Well, they came to the wrong country if they wanted disclosure.
The government didn't agree with that, and So remember remember that I was never part of a project. Like I was never part of a project to reverse engineer or anything. I was the welcome. In order for there to be technology transfer between the tall whites and the U.S. government, the first thing that had to happen is the tall white individuals had to learn to overcome their natural fear of humans.
Well, when you finally told your wife, Marie, about this, I mean, was there a point where she went, okay, sure, Charles, or, you know, did she pick it up right away and say, all right, I believe this?
Well, my wife, Marie, tells it better than I do. She said she didn't care if they were real or not, but if she met one, she wanted to make sure she behaved in a nice manner. And... kind of coined the term, but I'm not doing my wife's story justice, and so I'll let her answer that question better than me.
All right, she close by?
Well, she was. Marie, honey.
Come back.
She until 5 minutes ago. She was here telling.
All right. Well, she comes back. Ear, so. She comes back.
She can, she can tell her reaction way better than
okay.
I
now, know. When you talked about the propulsion system, sure. Did they come through a wormhole? How did they get here?
No, no. There's no such things as wormholes. Einstein was wrong about relativity. There are more force fields in, you know, like electricity, like gravity, like magnetism. Well, there's more of those than what Einstein knew about. And there's at least, and if you read my books, you'll see in the appendix, and in book five, I describe Hall photon theory, like in a beam of light. Einstein thought there were only two force fields, the electric field and the magnetic field, and Hall photon theory says logically there's got to be a third field that interacts with gravity. And there has, and see, once you take into, and that what's wrong with what's wrong with Einstein, when he says time slows down for real, if you accelerate towards the speed of light, he's wrong. There's missing terms in his equation, so what he's getting is zeros in the puzzle. And if you add the terms for those missing fields, you're in a totally different realm. And so, see that the double. When you looked at the tall white craft, and when you looked at the gray craft, they both had the same type of construction. They had the double hull, with like 1,000 miles of fiber optics in between those two hulls. Now the white technology was clearly better, the same way that a modern day Cadillac is clearly better than a 1944.
Ah, okay.
But that they were the same technology, the same gas engine. Well, the craft did is in the back of the craft, where they had the particle generators, and there were like five different particles that you can generate that are quite easy. You know, like, I don't know which five, but they're like, you know, like muons and mesons and stuff like that, you know, subatomic particles. And what you do is the fiber optics are formed into coils. You know, like electromagnets have copper wire coils. Well, you form the fiber optics into the similar coils, you create the appropriate particle that you've designed for down those coils, and that's how you get the force to lift and propel and turn and guide the craft. Well, there's a set of coils that's the outer coils that protect, when you power them up, it protects the occupants from the forces of acceleration. So that means that the craft is extremely high performance. It can do like 40 G turns is in nothing flat. It can accelerate at like 15,000 G's. You see, while the people on board just sit there because they're running with those extra force fields. And when you take that into account, that means that you don't have to go through wormholes. Time doesn't slow down when you accelerate or anything. It's just like getting into a high performance airplane and saying, let's go somewhere. And they turn on the engine and then you go somewhere. And so, as I personally observed, the secret to it all was the force field that protected the occupants from the forces of inertia. Well, remember I said there were five separate force fields, five separate particles that were typically used. And when you designed a craft, before you ever did anything, you said, I'm going to design a craft that uses force field one for various things and force field two and so on. Well, see, in 1954, when Eisenhower and those people were at Edwards Air Force Base, and the aliens had five different craft sitting on the runway, and they were showing it to Eisenhower, people missed the significance of the number five. The reason they specifically had five different craft is because they were showing him how different the craft were if you be depending on which force field you used to design the craft.
Each was different for them.
See, and that's why there were five, because there were five force fields. There's two more where the particles are reasonably unstable, and so they're only used in military craft. And there's another two that are very unstable, and they're only used in alien weapon systems. And so for a total of nine, you see. And see, because and when you realize that there's more force fields and you realize that there have to be more subatomic things called quarks, and when you take that into account, you don't have black holes. You don't have dark energy. What you have is other force fields, and those are physically real. Physically real means that they can store energy. It means there's a quark and a particle set that goes with them. And when you realize that light has more force fields inside the light, then you realize that Einstein was totally wrong about why the Michelson-Morley experiment failed. It failed because he thought light was only two force fields when it was three. When, as I describe in my books, that night I was coming out of the Airman's Club at Indian Springs, and I was looking at the tall whites up the valley, and they were 18 and a half miles north of me. And I was looking at the lights, and the light was very dim. I mean, 18 and a half miles, it was, you know, like the, roughly the, no, not brighter than an ordinary fluorescent light. But when I looked directly at the light at 18 and a half miles, the light coming from those from the suits that the tall whites were wearing, it hurt my eyes. It caused pain in my eyes, but took my eyes to feel pain just looking at them. And the only way that could be is if each particle of light, each little jobby of light, photon of light, had to be carrying thousands of times more energy than what Einstein thought possible. And in order for that to be the case, it had to have another field to store the energy. And therefore, relativity was wrong. Time doesn't slow down for real. Just because if the pain is real, then Einstein is wrong for real. If he wants to do the math that way and say, I don't know what those other force fields are, let me see if I can get some useful results, that's his business. But Einstein didn't say that he was just doing the math in that funny way. He was trying to pretend that time for real slowed down, which is poppycock.
Hold on, Charles. We've got another hour to go. Fast hour indeed on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Charles Hall with us. Paula Harris standing by, of course. She interviewed Charles and his wife many years ago as well. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, so get ready to take this ride. Welcome back to Coast, Charles Hall with us, Paula Harris with us. Paula, in your interview with Charles, what did you find to be the most riveting portion of that?
Well, I want to add, too, that we were able to, with the help of an LAPD policeman, to talk to four of Charles's, the guys that worked with him on the base.
All right.
I couldn't do the calling because after 40 years, a woman calling them, you know, their wives might have been a little suspicious. So we had Captain Coote call them. And they did verify what Charles said in the book, and people have asked about that. And we had the help of Steve Natale from LAPD, but we also had, for the first time ever, a forensic artist do a drawing of the teacher. And so she didn't think it was an Anaheim forensic artist. She didn't think it was weird. She thought that, you know, she wanted to give a hand. And for the first time, we had legitimate people working on this that were not into ridicule. And so we were really lucky back then because we did that. I put the picture of the teacher that the forensic artist had done on my Facebook. The most riveting thing for me was the kids. I had never done an interview that had children involved.
And then when ET kids, right?
Yeah, the ET kids.
Yeah.
The fact that the teacher would bring over the little boys and the girl, her daughter. The fact that the kids had clothes from Sears Roebuck catalog. The fact that they would walk into Charles's shack and be fascinated by his painting by numbers. The fact that they would stare at calendars in the wall, anything that was, you know, they loved the fact that he was sending up the balloons. The books are incredible, and I will say that everybody should read these books because there's in such detail that Charles is remembering things that happened that are just, for me, mind-blowing because for the first time in my life, I looked at them as people that had a culture. And, you know, I've done so many stories, and there hasn't been any story like this.
No.
And, then it seemed normal to me. Why not? Why can't there be people to bring kids? Why can't kids be here? Why can't, you know.
It's like Lost in Space.
Yeah, this is a way station. He said this was a way station. Well, that makes sense. So, yeah, that was the most riveting part for me, the children, and the description of the children and their behavior.
And, of course, we're talking about the Millennial Hospitality series. Charles, what, six books in that series?
Five
books. Is six coming?
my wife has a say in that, and so I'm not sure that I have an answer.
Right now I'm
happy with five.
When they came here, these various races of ETs, what did they want? What were they coming here for?
Well, the three different races, the tall whites, the Norwegians with 24 teeth, and the grays, came here at different times. The grays, it's my belief, they came here first, and they might have come as early, the grays might have come as early as the last ice age, because when you looked at the play, when, as I describe in book five, when you look at the way the grays tunnels were set up, and the way their agricultural stations were set up, it made sense if you assume they came here when the lakes, when many of the dry lake beds in the American Southwest had water in them. The whites came, I'm not sure when the whites got here, but I believe they were here at least as far back as the ancient Greeks, because the ancient Greek legends talked about talk about a group of tall white gods that came here from the direction of the star Arcturus and the Watchers, and so those two races have been here for a very long time. Now the Norwegians with 24 teeth, I'm not sure when they came. But my guess is, or this near as my estimate is, that they came here, they first started coming here in some very small numbers about the year 800 AD. And then as their technology got better, they could come more often. There's a big difference in the technology level between the Norwegians with 24 teeth, the grays, and the whites. The whites have the best technology, as I describe in book five. The Norwegian technology just barely allows them to make the deep space crossing, and I think they're coming here from either Bernard's star, the fourth closest star, or the next star out, Wolf, I'm doing it from memory, 579. The Bernard's star is out there at 5.5 light years, and the next star out is at 6.5. And it takes them 20 years to make that deep space crossing.
Wow.
They don't, however, the Norwegians with 24 teeth, their craft do not exceed the speed of light. But in order to make the crossing in 20 years, they have to accelerate for 10 years at 9 times the force of gravity. And then they have to decelerate for 10 years at 9 times the force of gravity. Their bodies are just like ours, and the grays and the whites also have flesh and blood bodies, very similar to ours. And none of them can take 9 Gs. The humans are built the strongest. And so that means that the Norwegian craft have to be surrounded by at least one of the 5 missing force fields that we previously discussed, because they have to be surrounded by the force field that removes the forces of acceleration. When I personally talked with one of the guys that was one of the Norwegians with 24 teeth, and I asked him about that, he said that their home planet was almost the same exact size as the Earth, so the force of gravity was the same, and that they adjusted the force of gravity on their spacecraft to be exactly the same as the force of gravity on their planet and on our planet. And so when they were making the 20-year trip, he said there was only one time when they, in the middle of the trip, after accelerating for 10 years, that with great preparation, they, tied everything down, and then they shut down the engines and all the force fields, and then rotated the ship in space so that they were running with the engines forward. and then fired up the engines again. And he said that was the most, that was the only time on the trip where there wasn't, where gravity was anything different than what it is on Earth. And he said that that was the most emotional time of the trip because everybody knew that if the engines didn't fire, they were all going to die. So when the engines refired, you know, when they first brought gravity back online and brought the and fired the engines, that he said they partied like I said like for a week, and he certainly agreed with the week, although it seemed like they partied more like for a month.
Smart and, people.
Yeah, and on the other hand, see the gray craft. I'm not sure where the grays are coming from, but I suspect they're coming from a star further out. I know they're coming from a star that's further out than the Norwegians. But the gray star is not all that far away. It's only they would never tell me anything. Everything I knew I had to figure out for myself. And I estimated that the grays probably were coming from a star like Epsilon Eridani or Tau Ceti at 11 light years. Because the grays good were coming point. From a close-by star. The whites were coming from a star much further away. It's not Arcturus. It's or the Watcher star. It's not the Watcher star.
How about Zeta Reticuli? Stanton Friedman thinks.
The tall whites are coming from a star. I think the best guess I could make of the tall whites is I think their star is, I estimate it to be roughly 105 light years away. And I believe that it's directly above the 20th south parallel, you know, like direct, you know, a southern hemisphere star. And I estimated that because when you'd watch the tall white deep spacecraft take off at midnight on the night of the new moon, they would land at sundown on the night of the full moon, but then take off at midnight on the night of the new moon, because they were very conscious of the gravity fields that surround the Earth in space, and whether or not the moon is in the way on takeoff or where the moon is on landing, and once they got above the Earth's atmosphere, they would appear to stop in space and then change direction and head directly towards whatever star they were heading for next. And the ones that came from the furthest away were heading towards a star just over the southern hemisphere. From Nellis, they were heading southeast.
Charles, let's take some calls here for you and Paula. Sure. They're lining up. Let's go to Sue in Dayton, Ohio. Sue? Go ahead.
Hey, George. I was going to wait till my birthday on Wednesday, but I couldn't wait. And daggone it, if Charles didn't answer my question, I was going to ask what star system they came from. But also then I'll go ahead and, because I know a lot about stars, and I know a lot of stars that people claim that aliens come from. It's not possible, like the Pleiades, no way. They're too young as stars. But, Charles, I think you might be right on. You're making me a believer.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
Yeah, you were talking about some of the stars that are possible. You're only going to get some stars that are like between the lower numbered F to the higher number K type of stars. Otherwise, you're going to get too much radiation from the OBA stars. And also, there's double star systems. I'm just letting
you read. You know your star system, Sue. That's for sure.
As you know, the mnemonic for keeping track of the star classification system is, oh, be a fine girl, kiss me right now, smack, you know? So I guess you could say that the stars that you're talking about are, let's see, fine stars and girl stars and stuff like that, right?
Hey, Paula, let's bring you in for a second here. In your research all these years, have you ever come up with your own theories on where they may be coming from?
No, not really. I have to. What I've done, my kind of research is I listen to the witness because the witness needs to tell me. But one thing that Charles did say, which was really interesting, I don't know if you remember this, Charles, you used to say that the teacher said it wouldn't matter what the name was because our names are different from your names of the stars. And I remember he said that to me, and it made absolute sense. We have our names for what's out there, but they may call it something different.
I remember that very well because That was the night that the teacher was standing, looking at the stars and kind of reminiscing. And I asked her what star they came from, and she looked at me and pleasantly and said, you know, asked, do I know the name that they use, the names that they use when they talk about the stars? And I said, no, I didn't. And she said, so if we told you, you still wouldn't know where we came from. And I said, that's true. And then they were all, she said, so why do you want to know where we come from? And then they were all laughing because they had reasoned me into a corner. And another night I asked her what her name really was, you know, because the teacher was just the CIA name. And she said, she explained that they can hear sounds that we can't hear because their hearing is as good as that of a dog. And their vocal cords can make all those sounds. And so if she were to say what her name actually was, I wouldn't be able to hear it the way she pronounced it. And if I were to try to say her name the way it really was, my vocal cords can't make all those sounds, so it wouldn't sound the same to her. So that's why they just chose names like the teacher or the tour guide or Range 4 Harry, so that because that way those words sounded the same to both them and us when we said them. And I said, and therefore that would also be true for the stars when they were talking about like the star that was their home planet. That you'd have to be able to hear those extra sounds to know what their name actually was.
All right, let's take another call here. Let's go to Jeffrey in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to phone in and just describe some facts here that may have not been mentioned during the course of the show. I've been the victim of attacks from these beings for several years now. Their appearance matches the description that the guest is speaking about. And I just wanted to phone in as sort of a wake-up call for people who are listening, that if you want to research just how evil these beings truly are, you need to look up the Alex Collier material regarding the Tall Whites, because as referenced to him and told to Alex Collier, these beings were cryogenically frozen children on their ship, and were also attempting to use souls to animate their hybrids on the same.
All right. Let me ask you, Charles. At any point did you see that?
No, none of that is my experience. My experience is that the Tall Whites, or just perfectly ordinary flesh and blood creatures, as humans are. When you talk to the women, they were very proud of the fact that the most common way for a tall white woman to start the conversation would be to ask me, "Do I understand that they love their children more than human mothers love human children?" And in other words, you know, don't touch my kid or I'll kill you.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
And on the other hand, if they came and they didn't start talking to me, because when they came, they didn't feel any need to start by greeting or say anything when they left. They just came and left to say, please. If they came and they hadn't said anything, I would, for my own protection, tend to typically start the conversation by saying, I understand that you love your children more than human mothers love their children, which was my way of saying, I'm not going to touch your kids, so please don't shoot me, you know. and within themselves, they loved each other. And the tall whites that I was associated with, each one was an individual, and they all practiced do unto others. When the tall whites came, if you could just stand there and not do anything, you know, not throw rocks, not hit them, if you just stand there, you could be scared out of your boots, but if you could just stand there, then nothing would happen. They wouldn't come and attack you or anything. They might come and look all around. The kids might even come in so close that you could touch, if you wanted, you could touch them. I never did, because that's like a quick form of suicide. You touch the kid, the mother will become really angry. They're like mother gorillas that way, where a mother gorilla in the jungle, you know, will come in with her child and And it seems like you could reach out and touch the child, but if you do, the mother kills you, you know?
All right, well, stay with us, Charles. Charles Books, by the way, he said he's got five of them under the Millennial Hospitality Series, and his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Paula Harris, of course, her website, you can search for her at coasttocoastam.com. She's been a regular guest here. So we'll be back with both of them and final calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Amazing story. What do you think? We'll be back in a moment with your calls, Charles Hall and Paula Harris on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Charles Hall with us, Paula Harris. Charles, the Millennia Hospitality Series.
Millennial.
The five-book series. Where do you get them?
You can get them from Amazon.com all over the world, or you can get them from my website at millennialhospitality.com, but they're available through Author House or through Amazon.com anywhere in the world.
Very good. And Paula, when you started doing the research into this particular case, and you've looked at a lot of different UFO cases, how do you rate this one?
Well, this one is on the top 10. Because of who Charles really is. I mean, Charles is not just somebody off the street. He's a military man. He has his records. He's credible. He's a credible witness. And you know that most of my work is with military
yes.
and intelligence people. And when he was telling me this, it just changed my paradigm as far as what kinds of aliens or people are visiting the Earth, plus the fact that his credibility is incredible.
What are you working on now these days, Paula?
Oh, I'm going back to the future. I'm working on the giant rock early contactees who met human-type aliens, because I really feel, and I'm going to go on record saying this, that we have made the gray the mascot for ufology, and we've got to go back to the Space Brother movement to understand who really visited us in the 1950s. And in the process, I've interviewed the top three Latin American contactees who had contacts in the 70s till today, who are meeting with human-type aliens. It's almost like the human-type aliens, the people from space, went down to South America because something happened here. So I'm studying Van Tassel, Angelucci, Adamski, Howard Menger. I have to go back to the 1950s to see what the messages were, to look at the documents. I've been to Giant Rock. I'm going back, and I really care about studying all of it.
And for you, Charles, what's next? I mean, has contact stopped? It's over, right? Or does it continue?
The last time that I talked with the Tall Whites was when I left the ranges in May of 1967 to go to Vietnam. On the one hand, I haven't seen them since then that I'm aware of. But on the other hand, when I was at the Laughlin conference, a number of people have said that a lady that looked like the teacher came in while I was talking. And so, the Tall Whites are that way. The Norwegians with 24 teeth, they're so prevalent. One time I was working next to one, a lady, for 6 months, and I thought maybe my mind was playing tricks on me, because the Norwegians with 24 teeth, they have the quality that they can, like if you're at a staff meeting, the women especially can sit there pleasantly at ease, in a manner that's so calm or relaxed that no human woman can imitate it. And I happen to notice that quality about her in the staff meetings, and I thought, my mind was maybe playing tricks on me. And then one day, just before she left, she came to me and thanked me for writing the books, and showed me that she had that she was genetically coded for just 24 teeth, and that she didn't know who she was. She didn't know who she and her friends were until she'd read the books, and that their parents had come here from the Norwegians. 24Ts have the policy that it takes them 20 years to get here, and they can return on a space available basis, but they must stay here at least 20 years, because about half of the time their spacecraft are so worn out they cannot be reused. And so there's no way, so only about half of them ever have an opportunity to return and to their home planet, which is half iced over. And she said that her parents, that there was a group of 20 of them, and they were homesick, and so, but they'd had children while they were here. And so they found, since money was not a problem because the government had given it to them, that they found homes for them here on Earth, and had the humans adopt them without actually telling. And the only agreement was that the whole group had to be kept together. You know, the play group had to be kept together.
That, I mean, it's still a great story. Let's wrap things up with final calls here. We'll go to Tamara in the Bronx. In New York. Tam, go ahead, Tamara.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This is fascinating. I have so many questions, but my big question, I guess, is how do they love humans? Why is their interaction with humans so limited? Is it by their choice or our government's? Why are there any interspecies, you know, orchestras or, you know, baseball leagues or, you know, because they seem to have, you know, ideas about music, art, and, you know, I'm curious as to what the religion.
All right. How did they live, Charles? I mean, what did they do?
Well, in the case of the tall whites, well, they have their own culture. They, at their base, they have, at their main base at the Indian Springs, back in the 60s, they stayed among themselves, and they were very social among themselves. They certainly loved one another, and they liked to do things. They got quite bored up there, and they would come into Las Vegas and stuff for entertainment. Each one is an individual, and so when you say, well, did they like humans, you had to talk about each one individually that way. It's, you know, how, because there were some tall whites who simply didn't want to have anything to do with humans because they didn't consider humans to be as intelligent as they were. Others, you know, like the captain that I describe in my book, the tall white captain, he was a nice enough guy, and he was perfectly happy interacting with humans. But if you gave him his choice, he would just, you know, go off by himself. He didn't. The others, like the teacher and the children and Range 4 Harry and tour guide and those, you know, had, you know, kind of an, it liked to tease humans and come in among them and stuff. New arrivals were typically terrified of humans. And so it was sort of like taking a group of tourists into the jungles of Africa and saying, you know, who wants to see the gorilla? Some, like me, don't ever want to go into the jungles of Africa and see the gorilla. Others, you know, want to go in and study them carefully. They're like that. Each one is an individual, and it's hard to make a general statement.
All right, we go next to West of the Rockies. John's with us in Fresno, California. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Boy, I had a far different experience in Indian Springs in 1968. I didn't see any of these things, and I was all over that base and security police. And during the winter, they sent me out on a Jeep with extra gas to go looking for a sheep hunter that didn't check out at the gate because they had a federal permit to go sheep hunting, and while I was out for 3 days, I was stopped by two guys in white uniforms because it was snow out there, and brought back to the base and taken to my commander's office and told that I was not allowed out there anymore.
Huh? What do you think the reason for that was, John?
Probably going. I was heading towards the Area 51 area, and because I saw some tracks, and I think they didn't want me to go and see that area.
Paula, what do you know now to this day about Area 51?
Well, I think you're going to ask me if I still think it's there or if it's been moved. Because it's become a tourist attraction. Is that where we're going?
Maybe.
Yeah, right. I've been there about 5 times, and I'm convinced that parts of it have been moved somewhere else. I mean, it has become a tourist attraction. I do believe it is a place of back engineering. I have interviewed at least five people that worked at S4 on Area 51. And I do believe that I will go on record and say I do believe Bob Lazar case. And, you know, I think that in the early days, you know, that is a top secret, you know, even airspace. You can't fly over it. Facility, and I do think that there's back engineering going on. There was back engineering going on. Now that it's so popular, it's even come out in the newspaper that it's legal. I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of there are a lot of tunneling going on in that area that could go into Utah. And so I think we really will never know. I don't think we'll ever know the details. Now, Indian Springs is on the other side, though,
right,
of the Area 51. But you have to go on the other side. And I'm going to add something else, George. Since I saw the town of Indian Springs, and there's an incredible story in one of Charles's books, I think it's the second one, about the teacher bringing her daughter to play with a human little girl that came out of the house and played with the daughter at night. Charles took us to that area where that, you know, human little girl went out the window. Her mother didn't even know it, to play with the little alien girl. And that's one of the things in the book that fascinated me, because the little human girl didn't know the difference when she was playing with the little alien girl.
That's correct, yes.
Well, Charles, through all of this, do you wish it would continue? Or are you glad it's over for you?
When you talk about dealing with aliens, remember each one is an individual, and so it's kind of like saying, well, when you go to New York City and talk to the people, you have to be very specific about which people, you know, and there's a certain tension dealing with extraterrestrials, because it was so easy, in the case of the Tall Whites, it was so easy for me to forget that they weren't human. And it was so easy for them to forget that I'm not a Tall White. Well, of course, if the day came where I forgot that if the day ever had ever come where I totally forgot that they weren't human, and they totally forgot that I wasn't one of them, then something bad's going to happen, and I'm going to get harmed, okay? Because they're armed to the teeth, and I'm, you know, I'm toast, you know? So there was always a certain tension where you wanted to make certain that, even when you were on excellent terms, that you didn't, you know, that I as the human never crossed a line, you know, like if the mothers came with their children, you had to always make certain that you couldn't touch the children, you couldn't order the children, you couldn't shout at the children the way if you were playing in the park and a human child came up and started, you know, looking in your lunch bag or something, you know, you might speak to the child and say, hey, that's my lunch bag, little guy, you know. You couldn't do that with an alien child. A mother might kill you. You know, if you had any problems with the child, you had to speak to the mother. For that reason, there was a certain tension being around them, even when they were friendly and they liked you, because you're never quite sure how they're thinking. If you made the mistake of pulling out a camera and saying, let's take your picture, well, maybe the guy that, you know, you're doing that to, the alien you're doing that to, you know, maybe his instinctive response is to just jerk his weapon and shoot you. Well, they could move 2.5-3 times faster than a human. So, you know, you always had to be, you know, like slow, well, deliberate. You know, you always have to say, well, now I'm going to walk to my weather shack, you know. So it makes a tremendous difference. Some, like tour guide and the teacher in Range 4 Harry, they were fun to be around, you know. I trusted them. Others, you know, I was afraid of. They were generals.
Yeah.
So it makes a difference, you know.
Joe in the Bronx, it's your turn. Hey, Joseph, thanks for calling.
How you doing, George?
Good, Joe.
I'd like to ask your guest, Charles. I had spoken on the show to Paul Hilliard and asked him about some of the medical instruments that I believe the Grays were using. He mentioned that there's a certain scalpel that they use during surgery, and they could just reverse the movement of the scalpel and it would seal a wound. Do you know anything about any of these special instruments?
lot of medical.
That comes from Colonel Corso, by the way. That's where that comes from. That's one of the things that Colonel Corso had from the Roswell, and he told me all about that, that the scalpel made the cut and also sealed the wound. So those things belong to the Roswell artifacts, not to this particular story.
Charles, what about cattle mutilations, animal mutilations? Anything discovered out at your area of Indian Springs?
No. See, the tall whites and the grays are plant eaters. They, you know, and they don't eat meat. And on the other hand, you know, so I'm not going to make any statement about cattle mutilations. I could from my other experiences, but right at the minute I won't. We're short of time. The one thing I will say about the grays is remember the adult grays can't breathe our air, and one of their breathing devices looks like a surgical mask.
Mm.
And so it is, and another one looks like they are a gray with a great big nose, or with a big nose. And so it's very common for, it wouldn't be at all unusual for a person who encountered an adult gray alien to mistakenly believe they were talking to a medical person as opposed to just an ordinary gray alien who was wearing his breathing device, his or her breathing device.